Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update. We're going to fleece you for that $24 after what you do sometimes to Rabbi Yudin postponing his presentation on Friday morning.
Well, tshuva is appropriate. I'm here, so I'll buy it in any form it comes.
There we go. Just imagine, in this case, all you got to do is take out the money and buy the book. If it was only that easy for every part of the tshuva process, huh? On this Erev Shabbos, we again reiterate it's our final weekly update of the year, and my gosh, it is amazing what is happening in this world of ours. Malcolm, as I wrote earlier today on Facebook and Twitter, the question that everybody wants to know the answer to is, will the United States, its allies, in fact, take action against Syria? Right now, up to the minute, what are your thoughts?
Look, I think that while there's a lot of concern regarding the possible ramifications for Israel, if you look objectively at the situation, I don't see that short of an all-out major attack, which will necessitate some massive response, I don't see Hezbollah attacking Israel and risking the kind of response they know that will come, because this time Israel will not be restricted, because Hezbollah is part of the government. They don't have to avoid, you know, official military and governmental sites as they had in the last Lebanese war. I think that Hezbollah is drained enough in Syria and has internal problems in Lebanon, knowing that people do not want to see them engaged, do not want to have the retribution, and they don't want to use the resources unless Iran dictates, and Iran does call the shots with Hezbollah, despite Nasrallah's bravado. I don't think that Syria would risk the retribution and the response that a single chemical weapon crossing the border from any of these, either of these countries, will immediately evoke an all-out response, because it's not something any government, and certainly Israel, cannot tolerate. And Assad knows that that's the end of his regime. So I think he will be very careful. It doesn't mean you can't have rogue elements do something, fire an errant missile or mortar, or try to incite the area. We have at least 10 of the 90 rebel groups, terrorist organizations in the Golan today, most of them, some of them native, some of them just having presence there. But I don't see them risking on this yet an all-out war.
Right, but the bigger question, which was my opening question, is about U.S. intervention. We see what Britain's reaction has been and other allies. Will the U.S., everyone wants to know if the U.S. is going to make good on what has been a relatively public and a public threat this week, you know, one full of bravado, one that I question whether it was a good idea to make so public. Is the U.S. going to follow up on it?
Right, and it's related to the response about what America has to take into account in terms of the decision. I do believe that the president wants to do something. He knows what credibility we have in the Middle East rests on it, and he has to look at what the possible ramifications would be for Israel, for Jordan, for what Iran might do. And again, I believe that they will be very careful, certainly in engaging directly. They would more likely engage with Hamas, Hezbollah, and they have little influence in Hamas right now. But and Hamas might seek to gain credibility again by heating up the border in Gaza. But America has to look not just at what its immediate interest, but what would be the consequences. And we don't know what Turkey is really advocating. Many people believe they are pushing the United States into action. As you know, they are a leading force against the Assad regime. And what would be the consequence if, let's say, Assad is toppled? I mean, we bring these terrorist groups to, many of them terrorist groups of the rebels, to power, or do you leave a vacuum in the current regime? Do they strike out even more? Does the army? So there are a lot of options. If you're the President of the United States and you're sitting with your team in the war room, as they are, hours and hours and hours, and I've talked to some of the people who were there, it is a difficult decision, especially after the British vote yesterday, which is very consequential. The only country still with us is France. Going alone is not the president's style. He likes to internationalize or multilateralize every decision. So the president has to look. His credibility is definitely on the line.
Right.
We've been hurt by what happened in Egypt. We've been hurt by what we haven't done in Syria until now. You draw a red line. You say it. You don't do it. Think of how the Iranians see it then. Do they believe that there'll be any red line vis-a-vis them? Or does the message that the West is impotent, the president and the United States will not act, even with this kind of a blatant action? Now, the truth is they want to wait till the report of the UN inspectors. We haven't seen yet the report, although the United States, Israel, others have definitely pointed the finger and saying this is this was done by the regime. Others have questioned it, but I guess the proof is there. We have four destroyers. We have moved other ships into the region, but so has Russia. And so for the answer to your question also involves the U.S.-Russian potential confrontation when Russia has moved destroyers, other things. I don't believe Russia wants an all-out confrontation or risk even a minor confrontation with the United States over this. But their show of power, the fact that they blocked action in the U.N. Security Council, which blocks the header that the president, the permission the president would normally want, I think that these are all factors right now there is no good answer.
So I understand that. But in this conversation, as you just said, not only is there not a good answer, but there seems to be no positive for the United States to intervene. If that's the case, why all this public declaration? Why Hagel? Why Kerry? Why Obama to an extent? Why is the United States taking this broad stand and really issuing international threats when the likelihood is, based on your analysis, that there's no way they're going to intervene?
I don't think he has a choice but to intervene at this point, unless the results of the tests, from the UN give him some cover, but I don't think that's going to be the case. America has gone too far out on a limb, indicating that they have the chatter that they've recorded, that they have satellite photos, that they know enough to have drawn the absolute conclusion. They didn't leave any wiggle room in the conclusions that they have announced. And the president left no wiggle room by his declaration about the red line, the statements by Secretary Kerry. I believe the United States is preparing an action. I believe the president is in a very difficult spot, and nobody should take glee in this, whether you voted for him, you didn't vote for him.
Right.
For the United States to be diminished means that the security of the West, the security of the United States, security of Israel, security of everybody is diminished. It empowers the worst of the bad elements.
Understood. Agree with all of that. What's the action then? And so if he's going to be, if his hand will be forced, then the action will likely be what type of action?
Well, every president since 1991 used tomahawks to do, whether it was in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, because, it's a sort of sterile way without having to put boots on the ground. I do not think that the president will put American troops in Syria. There might be overflights. One of the options that they had was to take out the Syrian army, which would have been a permanent no-fly zone. That would have aroused Russian and other objections, but I think they could have carried out quickly and it would have been over with, because there's only maybe 100 planes that they have operational. By now, they have sent the planes everywhere. Most of the military, there's not a single military target in Damascus where the people are still working. Government and military targets have been abandoned. They've moved equipment. The chemical weapons are dispersed around the country. So a targeted strike to remove Assad, I don't think that they will do. I do think hitting the infrastructure, command and control, some punishing act that doesn't bring us to the brink of a full all-out war.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us. The weekly update, Fridays at 7:40 Eastern Time. Keep in mind, the next weekly update, the first one of the brand new year, 2 weeks from today on Erev Yom Kippur, and then we don't get into a regular schedule until after the holiday of Sukkot. Assuming the world is still standing, and I will ask Malcolm if it will be in a moment, on Tuesday, October the 15th, the Conference of Presidents has their gala dinner celebrating 5 decades of leadership and achievement that they've made to the community. The dinner scheduled for Tuesday night, October the 15th at the Waldorf Astoria. All of our listeners are invited to make a reservation. All of the leaders of the last 20 years will be recognized, as will Malcolm as well. Information, 212-318-6111, 212-318-6111, or gala2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. Gala2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. Malcolm, do you think on the 15th of October, in fact, the world will still be standing?
The world will be standing. It might be shaking on its axis a little bit, but I do think that the world will be standing, and that's why I started off. First of all, the big question everybody asks me is about Israel's security.
Right.
So that's why I wanted to say that I do not panic. I think the likelihood of a major attack against Israel is very, very limited, maybe some errant action, some minimal attempts, but Israel's prepared for it. You know, people have said they haven't seen a big buildup of tanks. You know, I'm sure you many times saw all the tanks moving up north whenever
right.
there's a crisis.
Right.
Israel has missiles there. They have the Tammuz missile. They have other capacity. They don't need heavy armor in order to do what they have to do.
But we've read about reserve call-up and things like
that.
But
they're small. They're not major reserve call-up. It's a message, by the way. It's an internal message, but it's also external. The gas distribution,
gas mask
distribution has become a major focus, and there are fights, there are panic, and I think that the government has to do more to calm people down, because again, you have to prepare, you have to do everything, get people to be aware, and by the way, here too, and I participated in events at the New York State Department of Housing of Homeland Security under Jerry Hauer, and the NYPD had a briefing on Tuesday, which I spoke, but which addressed some of these concerns. And, I mean, nobody's taking it lightly, so we have to think about the consequences here. People should be on higher alert, not because there's any evidence or any report yet of a threat, but when Khomeini and his cohort say we're going to burn Jews everywhere, Israel's going to be destroyed, you got to listen to it
right. And
take it seriously, but not to panic. And I don't think anybody who has a trip to Israel planned should cancel it. I think people should go ahead with life as usual, just with a higher degree of alert. Take the necessary precautions. Go to the websites that describe what Jewish synagogues and security institutions should take places. But if you look yesterday, by the way, I think almost 170 members of Congress have told the president they want it cleared with them first. That Pelosi and Boehner and everybody else. So even domestically, there is not support for an all-out attack. By the way, 86% of Israelis, I think, don't want Israel to get involved in Syria either.
Right.
There's just not a stomach for it. And when you're facing kind of terrorist groups and these outrageous and extremist elements in Muslim Brotherhood, etc., in Iran, they got to know that we're resolute. They can't see the weakness if and not draw the conclusion that then get away with it.
And I know that I'm overstating the obvious, but just back for a second to your point regarding security in synagogues and Jewish institutions. A lot of people don't realize this Wednesday night is Rosh Hashanah. It's sneaking up on everybody. So if there are precautions that need to be taken, now is the time, because as you've pointed out many times, there are too many of our institutions that are ill-prepared when the big crowds show up for the high holidays and other occasions.
It's a very good point, and I think this year, because it's always, you know, Jewish holidays are never on time. They're always too early or too late.
Right.
So this year they're too early, and people don't realize that, you know, a day or two after Labor Day, we're going to be into Rosh Hashanah. For me, Rosh Hashanah is October 15th this year, and the dinner. But it's Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Tish B'Av, everything together. But you're absolutely right. This Shabbos is the time for people to make announcements, to take the steps necessary. I think if you have people who will stand at the doors, can rotate to be there to watch who comes in, who goes out, it's really important.
Yeah, no question about it. All right. There was a report this week from the United Nations Atomic Agency about Iranian nuclear activity being increased. I never know if this is a significant development in the whole Iranian in the acknowledgement of the Iranian nuclear capability? Is this a big step that the UN acknowledges it and recognizes it, or this is something that everybody knew already?
No, this is important because the inspector's report, which only happens now at most two or three times a year, that we get any additional official updates as opposed to, you know, the general updates and assumptions, that the report was of great significance in saying that there are thousands of new centrifuges. They believe, they talk about the cleaning up of Parchin, which is where they tested the triggers, and in case there's an inspection, but they've worked on it for years to clean it up, to remove any trace of evidence. The ballistic missile base, potential new facilities, and yet it got no attention because Syria eclipsed Iran, right. Egypt eclipsed Syria. Now we're back to Syria eclipsing Egypt and Iran, and it is really horrific because the report is very clear, and the conclusions are very clear. But you know, we cannot, unfortunately, despite all the capacity, all the technology, it seems we can't face two fronts at one time. And now when the attention gets focused on Syria, even Egypt is lost in the shuffle, and it looks like there's more stability there, et cetera. But this report was very important.
And Iran did say that if the U.S. or Israel does do anything regarding Syria, they're ready to attack Israel immediately. Why do you think Cameron lost the vote yesterday?
Look, from what again, we'll know more as the assessments come in. But number one, I think what the message from the opposition wasn't really to defeat the total possibility, but it was because they felt he was rushing in without enough information, and they were saying, "Give us time, you know, get us more data," which is what we're hearing from Congress as well.
Right.
And it raises questions. What happens if you know that there's a smoking gun or that there is a launching pad and something's going to happen? And everybody's going to say, well, we need to see the proof. We need to see the rocket fly. We need to see it bomb. We need to see the deaths. We need to see the blood. I mean, governments have to have the capacity sometimes to act immediately, mm-hmm. and not go through all the general rigmarole. I mean, democracy demands that there are rules and accountability. But, you know, we're living in an age where things can change on the dime. So I think the opposition, he didn't do the proper homework. He didn't prepare a vote. I think that he assumed he would get the vote and didn't listen to some of the warnings that I know were sounded about it. And frankly, there's just no stomach anywhere. Germany, you see, is not stepping to the plate.
Nobody wants in.
There is France.
Nobody wants in. It's as simple as that.
Nobody.
I mean, you feel.
But look what they do to the cops. Look what they do to their fellow Christians. And where's the response? They don't care about anything. This is such a dangerous situation that there's apathy, the indifference. I mean, if you want to know what we learned from Rosh Hashanah, that's the enemy. And here we see it. We see it become dominant. And the indifference, even sometimes in our communities, to the dangers you just talked about domestically, and everybody goes ho-hum and moves on. You know, all the things that we have warned about, the Sinai. This week they say 10,000 terrorists. How many months and months and months have we talked about it? And you see that the lack of reaction to this. You see Putin and Rouhani, the new president of Iran, meeting to coordinate on Syria. How long do we talk about Russia filling the gap, taking advantage of it? And the failure to get these signals, the failure to anticipate. Does the government, the Parliament of Great Britain really believe they'll be immune? They have hundreds of guys sitting in Syria today fighting who are coming back as jihadists.
Great Britain, as we mentioned, the U.S., they've made their position on all this very clear. Has the U.N. Done anything significant this week in reaction to what... Say it again?
They can't.
Because there's no official meeting?
No, because the Russians and Chinese...
They're permanent members.
Nothing. It's crippled. It's irrelevant. I saw that the special envoy for Syria, Rahimi, said that in Geneva that if the United States doesn't have UN approval, then whatever they're doing is illegal and under international law. Well, on the one hand, you can't get a UN action because you got Russia and China saying we're not going to allow anything. And on the other hand, does the United States really get hampered by you know, a recalcitrant United Nations, and then be charged with war crimes and all sorts of other you know, charges. I don't know what kind of massacre. I don't know what it takes to get the international community. And you see, it's not Jews this time. It's not Israel. Thank God Israel stayed out of it. But you also see this tiredness. Even Khamenei this week made a statement where he said enough is enough, and he wants the return of his 12,000 IRGC, Iran Revolutionary Guards, troops in Syria. First of all, the acknowledgement that he has 12,000 guys there. But that he made that statement seemed so out of character. But maybe it reflects the fact that, you know, even they get tired of it.
Yeah. So one thing we learned from this UN experience is that the Chinese and Russians certainly have Syria's back much more than they ever had Iran's back in the body of the UN.
No, they blocked many sanctions and watered them down and took other actions and continued to trade and to buy oil. And even if they're subject to some of the sanctions, they find ways, you know, to work within the system or around the system to get away with it. So Russia and China are out there. But you see, the Russians are playing a much more duplicitous game than the Chinese, I think. Chinese do everything to protect their interests, i.e. oil and trade. The Russians here are trying to stick it to the U.S. The Russians, you know, have been meeting with the Egyptians. The Russians are meeting with the Saudis, and as I mentioned, with Rouhani of Iran. They are trying to fill the void that the United States has left, that the West has left. And they move their ships in, and the message is, we stand by our friends. The West does not. They abandon their friends, sometimes work against their friends. We stand with them. And it has enabled them to come back, and he wants to be a world player. Look, Russia is not a superpower today. It is power, but not a superpower. But he's able to project this. It's very shrewd. He's using the limited abilities that they have to the fullest to be at least at center stage in all of this and sending a message to the region. You don't like that I backed Assad? I get it. But just look how loyal we are.
What has the PA said about all this in terms of intervention in Syria?
Well, the PA, as you know, has been opposed to the Syrian regime now, Assad, and they have been concerned about the treatment of the Palestinians living in Syria who have been caught in the crossfires, and many of them, by the way, have left. And it's another issue we don't even talk about, that the million or so or more refugees who have left and who are now 600,000 in Jordan and in Lebanon. You have more in Egypt, in Turkey, everywhere, which also could have a longer term impact. So the PA this week has been busy continuing its incitement, continuing some of their irrational behavior that we saw and that's putting aside the Gaza Sinai stuff, which was really explosive this week. The PA has been marginalized. The Abbas is planning a trip to the United States now to come next month, and he is just looking to coast along with this.
And that's in conjunction with the UN meeting?
Exactly.
So you mentioned the stuff in Gaza, Egypt. Is it affecting oil prices at all this week?
And by the way, there was a donors meeting this week for the Palestinians, and it was very interesting because I think it was the Norwegian foreign minister who chairs it said that we're not going to bail them out forever, and that telling them that they better get the house in order, and that they're not going to sit back. And this is exactly what he said, the comfort of internationally subsidized state building, meaning that they pick up the tab for them. And first time that we've heard this kind of a warning, especially from, you know, the Norwegian.
What is that? That's Norwegian money or EU money?
No, it's the collective donors who come together.
Meaning the EU or beyond that?
It's the EU, United States, those who supposedly contribute. But the fact is that most of them don't even contribute to it anymore.
That's pretty significant.
That is, yes, exactly. And so on the oil price. Look, speculation in oil is common. There is not a shortage of oil, but the threat, whether it was earlier with Egypt about the Suez Canal or now, there's nothing to threaten. Syria's oil represents less than 1% of the world supply. The likelihood that you'll close the Straits of Hormuz, Iran's not going to do it because they will pay more of a price than everybody else. So I don't think that there will be a crisis with oil, but it's sensitive to every international situation of this kind, and the price goes up.
It's still $4.50 in Lower Manhattan a gallon. I can't get over to. Isn't there something you could do about it?
Yes.
Fort Hood terrorist was convicted this week and was sentenced to the death penalty. But it's, I assume it's going to be. It won't be tomorrow afternoon that that sentence will be carried out, right?
No. At first, it'll be appealed, and it will be. I mean, the likelihood of executions, although there they actually do execute a lot of people, and
yeah, meaning in Texas,
if anybody warrants a death penalty, his actions certainly seem to do so. But it'll be a long time before.
But you still can't get anybody in the mainstream media to call him a terrorist.
They don't want to call anybody. We use the term militants. They use, and, right. And these words count. We sanitize everything. That's why there's never a clear line in the sand when you have such evidence and such conclusive evidence of an action. The words matter. It just reflects the lack of determination and willingness to take a clear stand. And frankly, if we and the West had taken clearer stands on issues, we wouldn't be in the crisis that we are in today.
Do you have any idea how many candidates there are for mayor of Jerusalem?
Well, was it 300-400?
I
know one dropped out, Lupiansky, and I know that there is Moshe Leon and Barkat, and et cetera. So probably half a dozen.
And this takes place when, in November?
Yes, the election is in November.
All right. This coming Wednesday night, the brand new year of 5774 begins, and there is so much, Malcolm. There is so much on the plate of the Jewish world, if you will. What would you say as we close out this year and begin the brand new one?
That it is true, and my fear is that people get overwhelmed by all the news and all the crises and stuff. You know, if you look in the Parsha now, where it says, "Ubacharta v'chayim," that you have to choose life, it's not always a rational decision. You know, the Jews who survived the Holocaust, seeing what they saw, for them to start families, to rebuild lives, was not necessarily a rational decision. But when do we choose life? We choose life every day, except that we're not conscious of it. We don't think about it. We don't. And many philosophers, Eric Fromm, others, have written about the whole this one pasuk and about what does it really mean and why does it say it in the context of the link between generations, that you have to remind young generations what to live for, not what to die for, that the Muslim Brotherhood and all these groups extol death, we extol life. And life imposes responsibilities on us. It means that you can't separate yourself from your community needs, and we have many people in our communities now who are in dire straits. There have been, you know, some cutoff of funds, post Sandy, post everything, that the demands of people whose personal conditions really warrant people stepping to the plate, that we have to look at the conditions in the world, not to become frozen and paralyzed by it, but to be inspired and to see the messages. And the Torah gives us explanations, and he says, look, this is all, it's not over the sea, it's not unreachable for you. That every person then has to decide what is it that they do to fulfill Bacharta V'chaim, L'matichi Ata V'zarech, that you, your children, and grandchildren, and all generations, because what we do determines their lives and determines the quality of their lives. And I don't think discussion today and what we've been discussing over recent weeks and the condition of the world as we see it should be such a blatant reminder of that. And this is what prepares us as we go into Rosh Hashanah to know what to daven for and how we daven and how we look at our own role in this context.
It seems that every we're speaking on an almost weekly basis for the last 12 years and speaking regularly for over 20 years, and it seems that this time of year there always seems to be a tension, an uncertainty, even more than at other times during the calendar. Do you agree with that, or is it just a psychological thing because the brand new year is about to begin?
Well, maybe it's because we're more aware and at the end of the summer you have more time to think about things. But I don't know that it's really more intense. We do it on a regular basis. In part, I think this is God's gift to the rabbis, so they have enough for their sermons to speak about. But right now, at this time, the rabbis have no shortage,
right,
for sermons. For they could, and I recommend that they all do it at morning, night, speak all the time. But the the situation that we find ourselves in right now is a culmination. It's a cumulative result. It's not something that just happened this week, which is why we put so much emphasis in an Ordo Domini. We look at the historical context. We look back because that's the way you can look forward and taking stock. So maybe you're right that you know, things tend to get heated up at this time of the year, but I'm afraid that this is going to be a year-round endeavor.
Right, and life is, of course, a very big theme this time of year, so the message hits home even harder, no question about that. Those who want to spend Rosh Hashanah with Mr. Malcolm Honlein, where would they have to travel to?
Woodcliff Lakes, New Jersey.
Interesting.
And we'll have a couple of sessions. We'll be talking about some of the issues. Other people will be there, too, to speak. And so those who haven't yet decided, I assume there's space. I don't even know, but it's a very popular program.
So you'll be delivering the Shabbos Shuvah, Joshua?
Right. And by then, the whole world will have changed again.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It'll be all new all the time.
Look what happened just over the past week.
And it's part of that's part of the answer to the question you asked before about the speed with which things change, that there are so many fronts. You know, I was giving a briefing for some officials, and I said it's not just that the issues, is the world so different? It's that we used to have one at a time.
Right.
If we had Egypt, that would be a big issue because it has ramifications for all of North Africa, for the Gulf. It's the number one country. If we had Syria alone, if we had Syria and Egypt alone without the Iranian thing, the Iran alone would be enough. And the second thing is that because of the interrelationship of everything today, that everything becomes so much more complex that you have to look at every ramification around the world. You can't look at the Iranian crisis without knowing about their presence in South America, their ability with sleeper cells in the United States, the infrastructure that exists here for them to be able to strike. That everything means that we have to look at all the ramifications of every issue, and the you know, you see them again blaming the Zionist regime for everything that that is going on. We see that the nature of the language doesn't change, the growth of the delegitimization movement, and again we had what's his name, the guy from Pink Floyd, Waters, and other cultural figures declaring boycotts and trying to prevent people from going to Israel on a cultural basis, and it had nothing to do with military, nothing to do with security or even politics, that continues to spread at this time. And as I said, we didn't even get into the things that are happening in the Sinai over the last weeks, and some of the showdowns, some of the attacks, and the groups that are operating, and for the first time, some people in the international community are even beginning to pay attention to it, not doing anything about it, but paying attention to it.
Unbelievable. There is so much going on. You're not really giving the Shabbos Shuvah drush, are you?
I am not giving it.
So, although, with these, if you did this for 45 minutes on the third day of the new year, it might spur some people to do some tshuva, let me tell you.
I have a hard enough time listening to it to be able to deliver it, you know.
Well, we take this opportunity to wish you a happy, healthy, and sweet new year. And it should be a peaceful year for everybody, Malcolm. With all of this, with all the things you discuss, you still believe that there's hope for peace and tranquility for both the Jewish world and the world at large.
I do believe it, but I believe it depends on our vigilance, our commitment, our tefillos, our mental state. If you look overall, I think Israel ends the year stronger than it began the year, because of the, you know, elimination or the diminution of many of those who would threaten it. It's far from a slam dunk. It doesn't mean that Israel doesn't face very serious issues, but we're seeing the map redrawn in the Middle East. We see us go back to World War I period with Sykes-Picot. We're seeing the breakdown of old borders, and no one knows what the outcome of this will be, what the reshuffling of countries like Syria or Libya or Yemen or others that are not even paid attention to today, although a lot of things are happening in those countries.
Right.
So this is a really period of radical change, and as I said many times, if you remember, that the promise of the 21st century for a new world order is yielding old world disorder that looks more like the 19th century than what the 21st century was.
Well said, well said. All right, Shana Tova, 2 weeks from today, we'll reconvene on Erev Yom Kippur.
Shabbat Shalom to everybody. If they want to find out about reservations for the dinner, they can call the conference office at 212-318-6111. Hopefully, by the time we convene again, we'll be sold out and we won't have to...
And if they want last-minute information for schools, shuls, and other major institutions that will be opening their buildings for the high holidays, they can go to which website?
Well, they can go to the SCAN, U.S., S-C-N, which stands for Secure Community Network, U.S.org. I know the JCRC has a website for it. Also, I guess it's JCRC.org. The NYPD has material that they have put up, Department of Homeland Security of New York State also. There are very good manuals. There are recommendations of steps that you take. And it's very important that people be trained, because if Chas v'Shalom something happens, people don't have the time to think. They have to be go into automatic mode,
right,
which is why we saw in Connecticut that lives were saved because teachers had been prepared.
Right.
It's very important. And people don't think that they're sure what you can do. You can't prevent something from happening if somebody's hell-bent on doing it. You can deter it. You can send them away from yours, and hopefully enough places will deter them that they won't carry it out.
All righty. Have a wonderful Shabbos and Shana Tova. There he is, Malcolm Hohnlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.